Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
To left. If it's fair, it's gone. Gordon will watch it leave. And that baby long gone. So the party continues at Napoli's, and the Indians take a two-run lead. There's a long drive, deep right field. Orlando looking up. It is gone to Souvenir City. Lindor home run number 12, and the Indians go up now 7-3.
Two balls, two strikes. Right here, right-hander against right-hander. The 2-2. Swinging a ground ball up the middle into center field, and that will score two. Vargas in. Suzuki in without a throw. Two gigantic runs. Fly ball left field. This one's deep. Trouble. Upton going back, looking up, and it's gone. A home run. Right. Dozier high in the air to left field. Two-run shot. The 0-2. Strike three, fastball swung back over the plate, heck of a pitch.
Sure did.
And the Tigers rally, but it fizzles with the bases loaded. Tigers scored two, but the Twins even up the series. Our final score, Minnesota Twins 6 and the Detroit Tigers 2. Kinsler, Maben, Cabrera to face him in the first. There's a swing and a fly ball, left field off the bat of Kinsler. Watch it fly, gone. 1-1 tie in the first.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza is right back with you on this Wednesday afternoon edition. We begin at 8 minutes after the hour of 3 o'clock, and you just heard last night's baseball and today's baseball all in one little montage there from Mr. Jim Cushlin. Tigers and Minnesota Twins playing the rubber match, and it is the top of the seventh. They are still tied at 1-1, yes, Jim?
Yes, they are still tied 1-1 in that game in the bottom of the seventh right now. Former Indian Mike Avilas is up, by the way.
I'm sorry?
Former Indian Mike Avilas up, by the way.
Mike Avilas, I always loved that guy. What a great guy. Well, I mean, seriously, I've interviewed him many times. What a great guy. What a great attitude that he has. You know, he knows his role. He knows what a utility guy is. He knows what a jack of all trades he has to be able to get ABs and to be able to get, you know, opportunities. And he always is a great team leader as well.
Yeah, and he just gets a base hit now to put two in scoring position in what is still a 1-1 game. A couple of home runs in the first inning in this rubber match so far, and that's been it. Verlander's been solid in this one. And, you know, for Mike Avila specifically, Bob, he's been getting a lot of starts this week ever since the I'm still scratching my head over how they sent Stephen Moya back down to Toledo and not Tyler Collins when they brought Upton back on Monday. I'm still scratching my head on that one, and that's part of the reason Avilas has been getting some starts out and right this week.
Yeah, and when you have a guy like that, that's the benefit of having somebody like him on the roster.
Yep.
Because no matter what the reason is, and obviously you're scratching your head as you say, he's the guy who can go in and play every day for a few weeks,
yep,
maybe a couple weeks, you know, and be moderately productive. And sometimes, depending on, you know, I've seen him have very, very productive streaks. And he's also the guy, though, that can sit for a week and then just kind of come off the bench in a pinch hitting situation and get you a knock. He's just a pro. He's just a pro's pro.
Yep.
And no matter what you need, if you need him to play a little more extended like you just described, then he'll do that for you. I mean, his average is only 205 right now, so I'm not sitting here trying to praise the guy to, oh, look at this. But overall, as I say, and I watched him for, obviously, the last few years in Cleveland that he was there, Mike Avilas is truly a pro's pro, and he's the kind of guy that you really like to have on your roster.
And so, even when batting 205, as you mentioned, he's still that kind of player that all managers love because he can play any position, essentially, as long as it's not pitcher or catcher.
That's exactly
basically
right.
Managers love that.
That's the jack of all trades that we talk about there. So so he gets the knock, and you got a couple on there. The Indians, by the way, if you're wondering, you heard the highlight there from yesterday. They won, beat the Royals last night to even their series at a game apiece. So this is the rubber match on getaway day there as well in Kansas City. Carlos Carrasco, Three hitless innings thus far in a 2-0 lead right now, the Indians over the Royals. That one is only in the...
That is in the third.
Kipnis. Now, top four.
Oh, top four. You're right. Top four. Kipnis and Naquin both homering for the Indians in that one.
It's a really interesting question, by the way, about Tyler Naquin.
Yes.
Something we should talk about because his, you know... I don't want to say it's a flash in the pan or whatever you want to call it, but you know he came up hitting and raking very early when he was called up this year. Obviously, he wasn't on this team to start. He came in and started just raking, and it just looked like one of those. Well, they'll figure him out, you know. Once pitchers get a read on him and what he doesn't like and everything else, and you know he'll slow down. But he has not slowed down even a little bit. And Tyler Naquin is getting some serious looks, and should, even though we're only in you know mid-July, and there's still a whole couple of months of baseball, 2.5 months of baseball left to be you know honest about it. He's getting some serious looks for American League Rookie of the Year.
As you should. He's let's see. As of right now, as of coming into today, 314, 10 homers, 23 RBIs, now 11-24 on the homer and RBI department, and therefore still over 300. And he should be in the running for it. What's nice is Bob is you got two guys right here in our region that should be right at the tip top for Rookie of the Year, Naquin, and the other one is the Tigers starter Michael Fulmer, who in some ways is keeping that rotation alive, especially with guys like Norris and Zimmerman hurt, though Norris is just coming back basically now. But he's been a nice bridge so far in that rotation.
Well,
which
Norris and
problems.
Zimmerman hurt and Sanchez being awful. You know, I mean, yeah.
And they had to start him yesterday because of those injuries. And predictably, as I think many Tigers fans would feel at this point, he predictably took the loss.
Yeah. And by the way, Justin Verlander, you said he was looking good. He's dominating, quite frankly, this Twins lineup right now.
I wasn't being generous enough.
Yeah. Through seven, he's given up 2 hits, 8 strikeouts, 1 walk. So
given that it's Verlander, I expect to see him out for the eighth.
Yeah, I would imagine so too. He's only at he's at 96 pitches. So I mean, they'll
make it 97. He is in fact out for the eighth.
There you go. They'll probably give him the eighth, and then he'll be done. And of course, at a 1-1 game, why not? But back to the Indians and Tyler Naquin for a second. This is just for today. This is just where it is right now. He's going to have to do a lot in the last couple of months to bolster this, but slash line of 314, 376, 593. There are two stats that really kind of jump out for me. First of all, he has a 1.8 WAR, wins above replacement, which of course is the baseball sabermetric slash analytic statistic that everybody lives by these days. I'm not as much of a fan of it, but it's there. And when you're a rookie with a positive, when you're a plus 1.8, nearly a plus 2 wins above replacement, you're doing well. Secondly, the bad side of it is I'm not a big fan of this 56 strikeouts and 16 walks ratio. A lot more strikeouts than walks, especially through 62 games. 56 in 62 puts you on a pretty bad pace for, a full season. If you play 162 games, you're going to be roughly 140, 150 or so strikeout guy if you played, the full season at that pace. But despite the strikeouts and the walk ratio, 314 with 10, now 11 dingers and 24 RBIs, 8 doubles, 5 triples, and I mentioned the 1656 and the 1.8 WAR. The guy is performing at a level higher with the bat than Francisco Lindor was. Francisco Lindor was last year at the same stage. We looked this up last week, didn't we, Jim?
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly what it was. But I know that we compared the two because Lindor, was a runner-up, and he very well easily could have been the Rookie of the Year last year. So this is a guy, talking about Tyler Naquin, who is, really making some noise and has been a huge presence on a team that needed him to be such. With Michael Brantley out, the Silver Slugger, and by the way, suffering a setback, which we can talk about too, in his recovery.
I think that's actually very important in part of this discussion on Naquin we're having right now.
Abe Almonte, of course, being suspended. And then, of course, Marlon Byrd being suspended and essentially having his career ended. Naquin has been an extraordinarily important piece of this whole thing. So, a lot of people kind of figured, well, he's up here, he's going to do a little bit. Made his debut during early April. Then went back down, and you kind of figured he might be doing the Cleveland-Columbus shuffle there for a while down I-71, but he has just said, no, I'm a fixture here now. I'm in this lineup. Here's that stat. Naquin at this stage is hitting, what did we say, 314?
Yeah, coming in today, 314.
And here's that number that I was talking about. At the same stage last year, Francisco Lindor, let's see, Francisco Lindor was hitting 241 at the same stage. Now, that means at the stage of the year, I guess. I'm looking at, this is actually an article on Naquin's Rookie of Their Chances, which is why I brought this up. A year after Lindor finished second in the running for the American League Rookie of the Year, could Naquin actually capture the award? Of course, at this juncture last year, Lindor was hitting 241 with a 602 OPS in 28 career games. Much can change over the final 10 weeks of the season. Naquin translated a scorching spring at the plate into an opening day roster spot, but he has to convince the Indians with his production at the plate and his grasp of the outfield position so that he belongs on a permanent basis. As we said, he started out in early April there, but then, of course, positions get a little tighter, and he was down in Columbus, but then back quickly. And
a lot of that, by the way, was in that first week or two. They faced a lot of lefties.
Yeah.
For just a weird quirk in that respect, and that's why he didn't get as much playing time, even though he was, quote-unquote, the starting center fielder out of camp.
He just may be piecing together the best season of any first-year player in the American League. And, so they give the Naquin numbers that you and I just referenced, and the second guy mentioned here is indeed, and this is in a Cleveland newspaper, cleveland.com, is indeed Michael Fulmer, who's 9-2 with a 2-1-3 in 14 starts, 77 strikeouts, 28 walks. He's been, quite frankly, the Indians' best, or the Tigers' best pitcher. No disrespect to Jordan Zimmermann, who had a great start, or to Justin Verlander, who's had the great career, but nobody's been better in 14 starts than Michael Fulmer has, right?
And it's hard to figure out. I mean, maybe Strasburg and what he's doing over with the Nationals
now.
But if you mean the Tigers, the only one that could compare would be Verlander, who's about to get out of 8 strong innings today. And right now, Bob, I despite me being biased, obviously, like you, towards the Indians, if I had a vote for Rookie of the Year, it's still going right now to Fulmer. I mean, what he's done as a rookie, we always have the interesting thoughts when it's a rookie pitcher, especially like, say, a first start. We always expect him to either look like Cy Young or he's going to get blown out of the water because, quote unquote, there's no tape on him. And you get to this point now, 14 starts in, and with an ERA still under 3.
Under 3, Jim, it's spectacular. I just mentioned it. It's 2.13.
Yeah, it's nearly under two, for crying out loud. Good call. It's nearly under 2.
Verlander in 20 starts has a 3.75,
sure,
and he's having a solid year. So if you just comparatively, I don't think there's any question that Fulmer, even though in 6 fewer starts, because he's got 14, Fulmer has been the Tigers' best starter.
And it's part of those numbers and being a starting pitcher right now, which is, if I had a vote, I would have to give it to Fulmer over Naquin for a Rookie of the Year, right, if I had to vote right now.
There's the other angle of that, or the other part of that, that we have to talk about or consider anyway, is whether or not writers, when they decide these awards, decide how valuable the individual is who's doing these things to his winning team. In other words, MVPs oftentimes aren't given to teams or to players who have great individual stats on last place teams. Not that the Tigers are a last place team. Obviously, they're in second and fighting to catch the Indians. But
speaking of that, by the way, I'm sure there's some biased Indians fans who could try to make that argument for last year in Lindor v. Correa, and Correa was on the playoff team.
Exactly. That's my point with this. So if that is a factor in the voters, making up their minds, and again, there's 2.5 months to play. So there's, either Naquin could go cold or he can continue doing this great stuff and rake and kind of do this thing for a division championship team, or, in any combination of these things, Fulmer could go, and struggle a little bit down the stretch, or even continue to hit very well, but on a team that doesn't make the playoffs, assuming that the wild card team does not come out, or a wild card team does not come out of the American League Central. So that could be a factor, but yeah, Fulmer has been the Tigers' best pitcher. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. He's been their best pitcher. He has been better than Verlander, even though, again, Verlander has been solid. Zimmermann was clearly the best for the first month and a half or so. He carried the rotation, but Jordan Zimmermann started to slump off a little bit there before the injury, and now with the injury, he's a less of a factor. But Fulmer at 9-2. 2.13 ERA, and as I say, a 77-28 strikeout to walk ratio. Yeah, you could very easily argue that he's the Rookie of the Year, at least as of now. Hitters, let's see here. Fulmer has limited the opposition to 6 earned runs over his last 10 starts. That's a 0.83 ERA in his last 10 starts. That's not a bad stretch, eh? That's Kershaw-like. Opposing hitters are hitting 153 during that stretch in his last 10 starts. Areas of weakness, hitters stand no chance with 0 outs in an inning with a 362 OPS, but with 2 outs, that's when Fulmer has a hard time closing out the inning as he gives up an 810 OPS against with 2 outs. And right now Fulmer is, according to this particular writer's view, this isn't Meisel, is it? Who wrote this? Hold on, let me double check here. Oh, it is. This is Meisel. We should probably just call Zach and ask him to talk about this. I didn't realize it when I was.
There's byline thing we talked about the other day.
Yeah, there you go. When we were digging, when we dig around for the day's top sports stories of the teams that we want to talk about, we always update the American League Central. And the first thing I saw when I looked up Indians was Naquin and the Rookie of the Year chances, and then you see the stuff from Fulmer. But I didn't look at the byline. But Meisel said he should be the favorite for the award. He's been the best starter they have for 2 months, streak of 9 consecutive starts in which he allowed 1 or 0 runs. And then there's only a couple of other names that are actually mentioned here in the article. One is Nomar Mazara, the outfielder for Texas, who through 85 games is .278 with 11 homers, 36 RBIs, 10 doubles, and his slash line is .278, .330, .413. Compared again to Naquin's 314, 376, 593. So from a strictly offensive production standpoint, Naquin wins that in 62 games versus 85. And then the other one was Hyun-Soo Kim of Baltimore. And 329, 410, 454 is very impressive, but only 3 homers and 11 RBIs overall in 46 games. So to me, I think most of those guys have a lead over him because he's not getting a lot of playing time. I think it's Fulmer and Naquin. I think it's coming down to Fulmer and Naquin.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
May
and
the
I'm
best
loving...
team win the award for that individual. Maybe the division championship, decides that award, assuming both of them play integral roles in doing that.
And I think both of them will for various different reasons, Bob. For Fulmer, it's kind of self-explanatory when you think about the Tigers' rotation and injuries and all the other stuff that goes with that, plus trying to keep them afloat as it is. And for Naquin, that expanded role and prominent role becomes bigger. As you mentioned, there was a little bit of a setback again with Michael Brantley, which means unless they're going to trade for a bat, which I kind of thought was unlikely and still at this moment probably is, then that means you're going to continue to go with an outfield of Rajay Davis and Tyler Naquin and Lonnie Chisenhall with Jose Ramirez / Juan Uribe over there at third. And Ramirez sometimes comes into the outfield, of course, too. And you're going to have to keep going with that.
I'll tell you something else, though, Jim.
Speaking of Naquin, it's now 4-0 Indians as he now has a homer and a 2-run double in this game.
Are you kidding me?
No,
As we were talking about him, I'm
flipping here in the studio. I got the TV machine because that's the fun part. I love when there's afternoon baseball. I love it, guys. When we're doing our shows like this, because I flip around, we feels like we're doing real news, giving me the updates. And yes, flip back after Verlander finished his 8th inning of work. It's 4-0, and the first thing I see was, oh, there it is, the replay of Naquin hitting a 2-run double.
That is pretty amazing. That's a great, great thing to see. And what I was about to say is, this is something that I know writers don't take into consideration when they vote for these awards, like Rookie of the Year. But maybe they should, Jim. Tyler Naquin's performance, if he keeps this up, and he has, and if he keeps it up for the next few days, leading up to the deadline, and we're 11 days away from the trading deadline.
Yes, we are.
I mean, if they feel like he can't keep this kind of production up, they might have to sacrifice some key pieces in the farm system to go and get themselves another offensive, bat, to get themselves another outfielder. Now that we know Brantley is very likely not coming back, and maybe not for the entire season, he just may be done. And I'm reading into that. I don't have any insight.
Right. I mean, he had an MRI with the setback yesterday, which is, yeah. I think, if you count the spring training one, it's the third setback in trying to come back from this.
Yeah, and now there's no timetable for
a return to action. Nor should there be. It's obviously too fluid of a situation. You almost, if you're the Indians, after this latest setback, Bob, even if you don't make a move at this position, you almost have to assume you won't have Brantley back.
Well, I think they already do, but that's my point. That's what would lead you, though, to wanting to make a move, to say, we can't win and get to October You know, with the, without Michael Brantley,
right.
We've got to find, you know, somebody to replace the offense, his offense in this lineup. But if Tyler Naquin continues to do what he is doing and makes it, you know, unnecessary for them to make a move and sacrifice something, that's got value. That makes him even more valuable than the runs he's producing right now. The fact that, you know, they have confidence in him that he, this isn't just a hot flash, this isn't just a hot start, that the kid just has this kind of game and this kind of offensive ability. And if he's able to hit, you know, to this level or close to it, you know, the rest of the way, That saves you pieces and parts and bodies and prospects and so on and so forth while still giving you the offense you need to push down the stretch to get into October and maybe win a little bit.
And the Indians obviously do have those prospects. As we know, it's one of the few things that they've done very, very well, you know, especially when, you know, as a Cleveland person, when you think of how bad the Browns drafts have been over the years. Honestly, the Indians drafts, for the most part, in the last 5-6 years have been the opposite of that. They've been very well, and so they have the prospects. And, of course, being, as you mentioned, 11 days out from the deadline, the rumors are already starting. For example, there were multiple Yankee scouts, apparently, I want to say, over in Akron the other day for Justice Sheffield, one of their lefty pitching prospects the Indians have, as there's rumors all about of they're maybe looking into Andrew Miller, because they have stated they want a lefty. Because I did read a stat today, I forget which article it was in, but they've only gotten 22 innings, the Indians, out of lefty relievers all year. And you know Terry Francona and his bullpen. If this is really going into and deep into October, you're going to need a reliable lefty. So that's one thing that's out there. The Brantley setback possibly puts the outfielders in play. And even though I've heard a lot of fans and others mentioning this one, as of right now, and I think it was Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports reported this one yesterday, the Indians are still reluctant to maybe look into Jonathan Lucroy of the Brewers, their catcher. With Yan Gomes now out for 1 to 2 months, depending on how long it takes, I'm right now estimating it'll actually be more like 6 weeks, put it in the middle of the estimation they gave of 4 to 8. So you got all those possibilities out there, and you're going to be hearing a lot of these kind of things popping up over the next, 10, 11 days?
Yeah, absolutely you will. And in the update specifically on Brantley, just to give it to you from one of their beat writers, Brantley's minor league rehab assignment at AA Akron was shut down after he experienced discomfort in his surgically repaired right shoulder. No timetable for a return to action given. They had been optimistic, and I didn't even know this, that they were optimistic that he may have been able to be activated during the current road trip that continued today in Kansas City.
That's why he was on the rehab assignment.
But I didn't think it was going to be that fast. I didn't think it was going to be, you know, like we're talking about a matter of days here. I thought this was just a matter of testing it out. Brantley, however,
it was. The main test was to see if he can truly play multiple days in a row, and that's essentially the test he had the setback on.
His latest rehab included batting practice, which led to a handful of these minor league rehab appearances last week. Though the Indians, trading deadline approaching. I'm just looking to see if it says anything else about the. No, they it's pretty much indeterminate in terms of how badly he re-injured it or what the discomfort is being caused by. So they're just saying no timetable for a return to any kind of action or rehab whatsoever. So I mean, this is July 20th for crying out loud. It is looking and sounding like he is just going to have to miss this 2016 season, and it's going to be, you know, going into the stretch drive, going down into August and September with the guys they have in this outfield now, unless they decide they need to pad the roster with depth, you know, professional major league depth, in the event that a rookie like Tyler Naquin cools off when the lights heat up and the pressure increases, which of course it does and will in these summer months. So it'll be interesting to see. But again, if he doesn't make them, you know, have any reason to do that, and he continues to perform the way he is, and they win the division, that's when I will change my vote, if you will. Not that I have one, but I'll change my mind that he is the rookie of the year instead of Fulmer, who right now I think I agree with Meisel and you that he has the edge, does Michael Fulmer. But Tyler Naquin, if he does this on a division championship team and continues to do so, may indeed edge him out.
Either way, look at it this way. For everybody listening to us right now, this is one of those beauties of being here in Toledo, essentially sports-wise, the midway point between Detroit and Cleveland. This is one of those small instances where this pops up, because either way, it sounded like we're all going to have a fun debate who should get it come, say, September. Because it will. I agree with you. Hearing some of those other stats from some of those and numbers and such from some of those other rookies you threw out there, yeah, the rookie of the year race in the AL, right now it's Fulmer, then Naquin, and then doesn't really matter. It's between those two.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's fun to have the whole Cleveland v. Detroit angle on that, too. Not going to lie. We'll have fun with that.
And indeed. And you know what? That might be the most fun that we have between those two teams chasing each other, because if the Indians do what the Indians can do, quite honestly, and that is with their rotation, pull away from this thing or pull away in this thing going into September, and it's not much of a race, not much of a division race. If the Tigers cannot match them start for start, which, I mean, let's be honest, looking at their rotations, they probably cannot. And you even were close to it. Remember when Cody was ripping you 3 weeks ago? I guess it's been now.
I'm still right about on that ledge. I'm not ready to fully pen it in yet, if you will. But it's back up to 6.5 after the Tigers lost yesterday. And then it could be 7.5 if this 1-1 game breaks the wrong way for the Tigers. Incidentally,
and the Indians are up 4-0 on KC now.
And incidentally, it is back to also the sub-conversation on that we had, Bob, is that it's really still now down to, I think, the Indians and then maybe the Tigers, because the White Sox are looking horrible again. They're below 500, 9 out. And if the Indians
did they win yesterday, because they had lost 5 in a row going into yesterday.
Let me triple check. I don't remember. No, they did win out in Seattle yesterday. They're on the West Coast.
So they snapped their 5-game losing streak. But
they're still 1 under .500 and 9 games out. And you mentioned the Indians. If they hang on and Detroit loses, it could be 7.5. Flip side of that is Kansas City would be at the 500 mark.
As long as we're talking about, and by the way, this is the reason why I don't believe, you know, and why you and other writers that we have talked to, we're going to talk to Fennec here in a couple of minutes, so we're going to have to take our break, but why so many people have said that this is the Indians' division to lose, and it may just be over, that nobody can catch them, because their rotation is that much more consistent and solid 1 through 5 than the Tigers, the Royals, or the White Sox, and we're seeing it right now, again, play out. Carlos Carrasco is through 4 innings. He has finally given up a hit, but he has struck out 4, not walked a batter in this 4-0 lead. And Danny Salazar yesterday twirled another dandy, and guess what? He might be, you know, in the conversation for Cy Young. I mean, he made the All-Star team, which is fine. It means he had a great first half. But when you're 11-3 with an ERA, where is he now? At 2.77, I want to say, and leading the American League in that category. We're talking about a guy who very well, 2.75, correction. You're talking about a guy who might end up being the 7 strikeouts yesterday and 1 walk, too, might be the Cy Young winner. So American League Rookie of the Year, Tyler Naquin, Cy Young Award winner, maybe Danny Salazar, the Indians. And Francisco Lindor has dropped a little bit, and he's at 3.01 right now. He had an 0 for 2 today, I guess I should say. I didn't see yesterday's box. But
I always keep that handy, because it's now 5-0 as Carl Santana in the Indians Royals game just absolutely launched
one.
Yep, 5-0. Gordon just stood there and looked at it, because there was nothing he could do.
But Lindor is going to get a handful of votes for MVP too if they win this division.
Now,
he, of course, is not going to be the MVP.
I think he should be. I agree with you. He should get a few votes.
Right. No, right. Nor should he be. And I'm not saying he should get first place votes either. But he'll get votes, you know, on the tier. Of MVP. So talking about, you know, pitching, a couple of hitters, a rookie of the year potentially, and a guy who's going to get some votes as the key number 3 hitter in this offense, it really, really is an amazing thing to see for them right now. All right, we're going to get our timeout as promised and get into the Tigers. The Tigers are getting into the Twins, and they are staying there. They are now moving to the 9th. It's bottom of the 8th. I guess it's bottom of the 8th.
Bottom of the 8th right now.
Bottom of the 8th. It's still 1-1, and Verlander is, what is Verlander
doing? 8 innings, a run on 2 hits, 9 strikeouts.
He's done.
He's still in the game, but I bet.
He's throwing 112.
Yeah, he's done. It's tied. It's not a blowout or anything, so yeah, they'll bring the bullpen, I think, in for
the
Tigers.
Innings, 2 hits, 1 run, 9 Ks, and 2 strikeouts for JV today. So we'll see what happens when the pen comes in to try to hold the Twins down and the Tigers try to win this one. Okay, we'll talk to Fennec about all of that and much more coming right up as we continue right here. So hour number 2, by the way, we're going to shift gears, and I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. We're going to address the Rooney Rule in the National Football League, which is getting a lot more attention now that new numbers are out. Statistically speaking, the minority coaching hires that had been kind of spurred by the Rooney Rule have now stalled under the same rule. And the question is it time? time to tweak it and do something else. It's a very controversial conversation, no question about it, but we'll have it because that's what we do right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
3:43, onward we roll right here on the Extravaganza. Kind of talking a little baseball this half hour, but we are going to shift gears. Fennec is not available, so we're not going to be able to have that conversation after all. Twins won, Tigers won. They are in the top of the ninth now, and as mentioned, Justin Verlander is done for the day. Updating the Indians as a couple of getaway games that are being played today. They are now pounding the Kansas City Royals 7-0. Carlos Carrasco has been brilliant through four. Just one hit allowed, struck out four, hasn't walked anybody, and the offense is dominating. Tyler Naquin, we were just talking about his Rookie of the Year candidacy. 2-for-2 with three driven in today. He's now hitting 322. He's got a 322.
That's what it's up to, 322 now?
322, nice. 382, 621 slash line right now. So, pretty good stuff. You also have Napoli with Baum. He's got two driven in, and did you say Santana went yard, right?
Santana. Yes, Carl Santana.
Who's got his average, by the way, for those who have not been paying attention to Carlos Santana and who have been very critical of him, and I'm one of them. I'm going to give credit where it's due. I've been critical of this. He used to be when he came up and he was this tremendous prospect, the best hitting prospect in the Dodgers organization when he came over in the Casey Blake trade, which is amazing. It sounds like just eons ago.
Wasn't that 2008, I think?
I don't know. Maybe.
It was 2008 because he was still obviously an Indian during the 07 playoff run.
Yeah, which is weird, because I relate Casey Blake to an entirely different era of Indians baseball. And yet, there's the direct connection to it. It led to Carlos Santana, who was just the best hitting prospect they had. And then we all know what happened. He started out being just that, a great prospect, being a 260, 270 type hitter with good power. Wasn't the best defensive catcher, but did have a cannon behind the plate. We saw what has happened since then. He's kind of a guy without a position most of the time. He can play some first base. They tried him at third base, epic fail. So he's just a DH. But it was a DH who just, was hitting 230 most of the time the last few years, sometimes struggling to get over the Mendoza line and, showing some power, not all-star power, but some power and, but still hitting for a very low average. And don't look now, but Carlos Santana's got the average up to 256. He's pushing up near that 260, 265, 270 that he showed he can hit in his first couple of years, full-time in the big leagues. And hasn't done it since, but he's doing it now.
Yeah,
or at least he's climbing there now with a 256 a batting average and a 350 on base. That on base percentage was his saving grace during all of this.
Because he's always right up there at the top of the league in walks. Yeah,
because he's got a very good eye, which again is fine for a leadoff hitter with speed, but not for a guy who's supposed to be a power hitter. And lo and behold, Terry Francona's gotten him hitting leadoff.
Right.
And that's what he's doing. But the batting average is starting to climb up a little bit. He's at 256. So, which is pretty amazing, to see that improvement.
You know, what's interesting on that subject, too, is the – and I know 256 is still not that great. But where it really comes for Carlos Santana is, at least for me this year, and I may only be speaking for myself, I haven't had to have – weeks on end where I'm complaining about him and his ridiculously low batting average. What, it was half the season he was below the Mendoza line or even below like 190 or something like that for at least half the year last year. The fact that I have not complained once this year about his average and being really horrible tells you all you need to know on Carlos Santana's season this year.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And just to run him down for you, it was 2010 was his first year. With the Indians. He played in 46 games.
Then had that injury.
He hit 260, six home runs and 22 RBIs in just 46 games. His first full year was 2011. He hit 239. Again, much lower than expected, but he had solid power, 27 and 79 homers and RBIs. 2012, 252, getting back up to that respectable area. Powers a little bit down, actually, with 18 home runs, but still a 76 driven in. 2013, 268. This is what we're talking about. This is the growth. This is what it ought to be. 268 with 20 home runs and 74 RBIs. But then the last 2 years, 231 both seasons. 231 is unacceptable for a guy, who's got that 265, 270 ability. But he did have 27 home runs and 85 RBIs in 14, 19, and 85 last season. But the walk totals, as you point out, were high, and that's what gave him the higher on-base percentage, which kind of was his saving grace during all of this. So that's where we are. Just a little update for you there on daytime baseball today. Indians up 7-0, top of the fifth in Kansas City, trying to take two out of three there. The Tigers, I don't want to say scuffling, but the Twins suck. They ought to be beating them, not scuffling and struggling with them. Top of the ninth there, 1-1 in the rubber match of that series. I want to shift gears, and we're going to kind of have to lay the table here, lay the groundwork, I should say, and set the table as I mix my metaphors. And kind of set this up and talk more about it after the top of the hour, because we won't be able to take phone calls right now on it. But the Rooney Rule, which we all know as named after Dan Rooney, because he, the president of the Pittsburgh Steelers, was the driving force behind a movement to try to hire more minority coaches. It has long been considered to be an embarrassment that, such a tiny, small amount of head coaches and offensive coordinators in the offensive and defensive coordinators in the National Football League were African-American, or minorities at all in general, because we've got to include Latinos in there, like Ron Rivera of the NFC champion Carolina Panthers. But it was just kind of believed to be some sort of regressive thing, maybe not outwardly racist on the part of any of the owners making the hires or the general managers, but just that in a league which has a predominant number of minority players, to have so few minority coaches and coordinators, it was just deemed to be unacceptable. They have to do something about that. So the Rooney Rule was implemented, which requires, of course, every team to interview at least one minority for any job, any of the higher positions that are open, including general managers, head coaches, offensive and defensive coordinators. I don't know if that go to special teams coordinators too. Do they have to do that for special teams?
You know what? That's a good question. I would assume yes, but I could easily be wrong.
And not that it really matters too terribly much, because generally speaking, special teams coordinators do not get moved from special teams coordinator to head coach. Most of the time, head coaching promotions come from offensive or defensive coordinator positions, which is why they wanted to make sure that there was a path to head coaching opportunities for minorities by getting them into the offensive and defensive coordinator positions, obviously. Well, ESPN did a little study on this, or at least responded to the study, showing that, quite honestly, the Rooney Rule, which was doing a terrific job in the early going of getting more opportunities for African Americans, despite concerns, and legitimate ones, that some of these interviews that would be granted would be just to meet the requirement. And in a bit of a, in a negative way, not to use a slur, and I guess it's not really a slur anyway, but sometimes considered to be token interviews. You have got to interview a minority, so let's bring this guy in, or let's bring one of our own position coaches in and interview him, say, look, we met the requirements of the rule, we gave an interview to a minority, but they really had no intention of possibly hiring him. So despite all of those little, flaws and peccadilloes with the rule, more opportunities were given and more minority coordinators and coaches were being hired, but that apparently has plateaued. They have hit a bit of a stalemate here, or a stall, whatever you want to call it, and the opportunities are not there and continuing to be advanced for minority coaches. So I want to give a little bit of a report here from ESPN on this subject, and then I want to talk about it with you about what needs to be done, if anything at all needs to be done about it. So let's give this a quick listen.
Just the extent to which Dungy's coaching tree accounted for the gains of the last 10 or so years was striking. And every time I shared those numbers with coaches in the league, just wow. And then the second part was there are 85 coaches in the league right now who are offensive coordinators, who are quarterbacks coaches of some sort, or offensive quality control coaches. That's a typical chain of advancement in the league. Of those 85 guys, 80 are white. So, when we ask these owners why they're not interviewing more minority candidates, well, you got to get them into those positions probably too, and you have to reassess what makes a great head coach. Why is it the coordinator? When you look at the guys who are successful in the league, whether it's Mike Tomlin, whether it's Bruce Arians, Pete Carroll, is it their amazing scheming ability, or is it their leadership, their ability to relate to people? why aren't we talking to some running back coaches or just guys who may do very well as a head coach without being the typical quarterback coach, offensive coordinator?
That is just some of the analysis from ESPN. And I want to address some of that, and I want you to as well. And when we'll take your calls again, probably not till after the top of the hour at 866-240-1065. And I think it's a bit of a rhetorical question when he asks what makes a successful coach. Is it his ability to scheme and X and O better than everybody else, or is it leadership? Is it opportunities to just kind of let your personality drive players onto bigger and better things? And I think it's either rhetorical in that it doesn't need an answer, or it is a self-answering question. And the self-answer is everybody is different. You know, Mike Tomlin, I don't think has ever been given credit as a strong X's and O's guy who's out scheming anybody. In fact, he's kind of seen as a wild card. He's the riverboat gambler who goes for it on fourth down more than anybody else. Mike Tomlin, the black coach of the Steelers, is the guy who goes for two-point conversions more than everybody else. He is also the guy that has been criticized by Steeler fans and media for some mistakes when it comes to X's and O's decisions. But he's a leader. Guys love him. They love playing for him. He's one of the most successful coaches among minorities, but not just minorities, but just, you know, coaches, period, because guys really, really like playing for him. He's a player's kind of a coach in that he will get up in there, you know, what's, if that's what it takes to motivate him, but he is the, pat on the back guy, if that's what it takes to motivate this guy. He's just good with people. Marvin Lewis is another minority coach, obviously, who is who's got more lives than nine cats do, which, if I'm doing my math right, is 81 lives, because Marvin Lewis has been on the bubble, if you will, and on the hot seat for over a decade, but he never loses his job. He's also a guy who never wins playoff games. Guy who gets there, can't win playoff games, then, you know, kind of mixes in playoff seasons with playoff losses with occasional horrible seasons, the kind that would get almost everybody else fired. But yet Mike Brown down there in Cincinnati doesn't really seem to like the idea of paying somebody to not coach by firing them and then having to hire somebody else to do it. So he has skated by. Same kind of a thing, though. You know, a lot of people just say that, he's a good player's coach. Players certainly love him. Everybody who goes to Cincinnati loves Marvin Lewis, but maybe isn't the best schemer. And then you take a look at a guy like Hugh Jackson, who is now, of course, the new head coach of the Cleveland Browns, who came from, most recently, Cincinnati, where he worked for Lewis. He's also been a head coach in Oakland. He's a guy who is well regarded as just a technical quarterbacks coaching kind of guru from a scheming standpoint, from a coaching offense standpoint. He's a guy that, you know, whether or not he's the most likable or the most player-oriented is not really, you know, something that we have an answer to yet. But he is well-regarded as a schemer. If you look at NFL championships, look at guys like Bill Walsh. Obviously an exceptional offensive schemer, an exceptional game planner, one of the greatest coaches of all time. Bill Belichick, probably more on the defensive side, one of the greatest of all time in terms of game preparedness, not necessarily very coochie-coo and cuddly to the guys. Aren't a whole lot of players who come out of New England saying, boy, I really loved playing for Bill Belichick. They don't really like that. Bill Parcells, Super Bowl champion, screamer, yells at you, embarrasses you, calls you out. Once called Terry Glenn, the Ohio State wide receiver product in Dallas, once called him a she in a press conference referencing not tough enough to be an NFL impact player kind of a thing. So there are leaders of men who hire the right people around them to scheme and to game plan. And then there are schemers and game planners who rely on assistants to be the, you know, the leader types to really, you know, get everybody motivated the proper way. There is no right or wrong way. And because there is no right or wrong way, the inference that we were just hearing in the ESPN report, I think, is a false one. Because if there's no right or wrong way, there's no black or white way. There just isn't. There's no black or white way to coach and be successful. If you look at all of the championship caliber coaches who have been down the line, and again, from whites to blacks to Latinos like Ron Rivera, who came within a whisper of winning a Super Bowl last year, you're going to find a mixed bag of results in all of them in terms of style, ability, etc. So the question then becomes, if there's no right or wrong way, there's no black or white way, what, do we need to make a big deal out of the fact that so few head coaches are minorities? Do we need to make a big deal out of the fact, as reported, that 80 of the 85 current head coaches, offensive coordinators, or offensive, no, I'm sorry, not head coaches, 80 of the 85 offensive coordinators, quarterbacks coaches, or offensive quality control coaches in the league, that 80 of the 85 are white? Is there a bias there of any kind? Or is it just coaches and GMs looking for results and hiring guys that they think can deliver those results for whatever reason, you know, that they do, knowing full well that those positions just named are the ones that are eventually promoted, end up having promotions made to the head coaching position? Is there something else that needs to be done beyond the Rooney Rule? Or is this something where people just need to recognize, hey, talent is talent, and if it's there, it'll be discovered, just like it is in players. Talent in coaching will be discovered no matter what color, ethnicity, race, or whatever it is that we're talking about. So let's get into that a little bit on the other side of the top of the hour Sports Center.
However, before you do, if I may.
Yes.
Okay, two things. First, Tyler Naquin now has 2 home runs and 6 RBIs on the day, and that game's now 11-0.
He hit another bomb. Are you kidding me?
A three-run shot. That game is 11-0 going into the sixth. The other side of it is, and for Tigers fans, you're probably pulling your hair out at this one. K-Rod just gave up not one, but 2 homers in
yes,
a tie game
did.
In the ninth. 4-1. He just got pulled by Brad Ausmus, so it's not looking good for the Tigers, and it's looking very good to go up to 7.5 at this point for the Indians. Yes, Tyler Naquin is 3-for-3, a solo homer, 3-run homer, 2-run double. That's 6 RBIs on the day.
Let that be a lesson. Let that be a lesson to Brad Ausmus. Justin Verlander gets to throw 140 pitches a night or a day. I don't care if he was at 112 after 8. Bring him back out, and if he's got to go to 130 or 140, you let him do it. Otherwise, this is the result.
Because the stats bear it out. Closers in non-save situations. I still don't know why. It feels like it's mostly mental, Bob, but they're just different in non-save situations.
Wow.
Stats will back that up.
What a waste of a day for Verlander.
Yes.
Just in case you missed it, 8 innings, 2 hits, 1 run, it was earned, 9 strikeouts, just 2 walks. Justin Verlander pitched a beauty, and K-Rod, Francisco Rodriguez, in 2/3 of an inning, 2 bombs, 3 runs,
Max Kepler, Eddie Rosario for the Twins homers, and if you're going, huh, who, you're not alone.
Well, there it is. And then, meanwhile, cruise control for Carlos Carrasco with an 11-run lead, and he's given up 1 hit through 4 innings. Are they still batting? It's the middle of the fifth now. Okay, it's the middle of the fifth.
I was going to say, I was pretty sure we got to the middle or bottom of the fifth by now.
That's a long, long layoff there. We'll see how Carrasco comes out for the fifth or the bottom of the fifth, because that's a long time to sit in there. That seemed like they were batting in that inning. I mean, was there a rain delay or something? Because that half inning seemed like it took forever.
No.
How many men did they send to the plate?
That's what I'm actually triple-checking right now, because I it was a 7-run inning first off. Let me see. I'm going to check, because I
got
to count
it.
Okay.
I got it. Top 5 for the Indians. Santana led off with a homer to right. Kipnis struck out looking. Lindor was hit by a pitch. That's 3. Napoli homered to center to score, him and Lindor. Let's see. Ramirez walks. So 1, 2, 3, 4. That's 6 men to the plate. No, 5 men to the plate. Chisenhall singled. That's 6 men to the plate. Davis singled, scoring Ramirez. That's 7. Naquin homered to center, scoring Chisenhall and Davis in front of him. So that's 8. Perez grounded out for the second out. Santana walks, so that's 9 and 10. Kipnis singled, that's 11. And then Lindor grounded into a fielder's choice. They sent 12 men to the plate. They sent 12 men to the plate in the fifth. Carlos Carrasco probably went and had a massage and probably a Chipotle burrito.
He certainly had the time.
In between pitching. So he comes out for the bottom of the fifth. Now with an 11-run lead, we'll see what happens there. But it looks like the lead is going to be boosted back up to 7.5 in the Central for the Indians over the Tigers as we move now within 12 days of or 12 days, because August or July 31st is the deadline. So we'll say 11 days of the actual trading deadline. All right, now having said all that and blowing right past our SportsCenter top of the hour break, let's take that break and come back and talk some football coaching right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Kipnis launches one. Deep right center, Orlando back, on the track, at the wall, he's out of room, it's out of here, and the Indians will play from in front. It's a fly ball hit pretty deep to left field, back is Eibner, he's out of room, and it is, I lost it, it's gone. Just did clear the wall, and Tyler Naquin has gone oppo for the Indians' second home run of the day. Naquin rips it down the right field line. That'll go into the corner. Chisenhall scores. Rajay Davis rolls around third. He'll score two. Naquin stops at second base with a two-out, two-run double to make it a 4-0 Indians lead.
All right.
Kinsler, Maben, Cabrera to face him in the first. There's a swing and a fly ball. Left field off the bat of Kinsler. Watch it fly. Gone. 1-1 tie in the first. A-Rod's trying to make it a 1-2-3 ninth in a 1-1 game. The 3-2 pitch. Swinging a drive to right field. Way back in right and gone.
Change up.
Max Kepler absolutely crushes the 3-2 into the right field seats, and the Twins take a 2-1 lead.
It was a change up in his happy zone.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
So we're trying to get into some football talk here a little bit as we head into hour number two. 4:11 is our time. We've got you until 5 o'clock when drive time comes your way. Cushlin in for Mike Miller today. So we're trying to talk some football, but obviously with the baseball montage from the start, and then obviously even more so with the baseball results going the way they are and the constant change, we've had to keep you updated on this. They are now in the top of the sixth in Kansas City, where the Indians lead the defending world champion Royals 11-0. That's right, 11-0, as they've just exploded on Kansas City pitching. Carlos Carrasco, meanwhile, continues to cruise. He struck out another in the fifth, so he is through five, one hit, five strikeouts, not a single walk. His ERA down to 2.34, which is among the best in the American League. It just doesn't qualify for the leaders in the American League due to number of starts and innings pitched. Do you know what that where that cutoff is? I keep looking for him to appear, Cushlin, among the league leaders.
Oh, you mean in ERA or something?
Yeah, in ERA. In ERA, because his ERA is 2.34. It's like second. It would be right around second best in the American League, behind maybe only Salazar. Let me take a look real quick here before we go on to the football conversation that I have been wanting to start or to continue anyway. Individual pitchers in the American League, Salazar leads with a 2.75. It would be the best ERA. He has been pitching, let's see. Salazar has 18 starts and 111 innings pitched. And I'm just going to look down among the other leaders to see what their pitch, their innings pitched, because I'm sure it's just by innings pitched. Corey Kluber's 129. Here's Colby Lewis is there with Texas with 98. 93 for CC Sabathia. I'm just looking at some of the lower numbers to see if we have an idea where the cutoff is.
Because I know it always varies until you get to the end of the season, and it, like batting average, you have to.
Right.
I don't know, and I wouldn't.
Or plate appearances.
Exactly, and yeah, I apologize. I don't know what it is right now, but then again, we're still in season, so it'll constantly change.
Yeah, I know, but I just want to know because obviously that means eventually he will qualify. He spent over a month on the DL, so that's why he doesn't have enough innings right now. But eventually, in season, he will qualify. You know, for the ERA title, if you will. And I just want to know where it is. His innings number right now is 79. So through 13 starts, 79 innings, that puts him roughly, I don't know, 10 to 15 innings shy of where some of the lower numbers are that are included in the list for league leaders. CC, like I said, is 883. Anybody lower than that? Or I'm sorry, 93. So he's like 14 innings shy of the lowest guy that I can see who is among the league leaders in ERA. So once he gets to that threshold, whatever it is, he will be the ERA leader in the American League. You know,
as he probably should be. I mean, you know, that's what happens when you miss a month. You get off the those qualifying lists. I remember, wasn't it last year? It was last year for the longest time. Miguel Cabrera was bordering on that qualification level. He eventually got enough bats to qualify. That's why
you may forget,
but he won the batting title last year in the American League.
Barring another trip to the DL, he will eventually get to that threshold and qualify, and suddenly he'll take over as the leading pitcher in the league.
Yes.
His ERA is 2.34, and he has been every bit as good as 2.34 sounds that he would be. Carlos Carrasco, and that's including, again, the stint on the DL and then pitching coming off of it with some rust and on a pitch count limit and an innings limit, et cetera. He has just picked right back up where he was. He had one bad start to end the first half. Did Carlos Carrasco. But
I know, I was at that game.
Oh, there you go. So you know what I'm talking about. That one.
It's probably my fault then.
He is. There it is. You are to blame. But he has just been lights out. So anyway, Indians are going to win in Kansas City. The Tigers looks like they are going to lose there in the bottom of the ninth, down 4-1.
That means it'll be back to seven and a half, and Kansas City will be below 500. So only Detroit and Cleveland will be even above 500 when these games all conclude.
Think about that for a minute. Wow, I didn't even consider it from that standpoint. That's very interesting to me because we kind of thought that the American League Central. Well, I mean, there were different thoughts on it. I thought that there would be four really good quality teams there fighting for this division championship, nip and tuck, all summer long. And now, I mean, if two of them slip below 500, you know, then it's just four teams, not necessarily four quality teams. And the Indians may indeed be pulling away to make it not even a nip and tuck situation. So taking a look at the schedule, if I can, just real quick. Tomorrow, the Tigers are at Chicago.
Chicago. They get both Sox on the road in a row. It's four at Chicago, and then Monday they start a series at Fenway.
At Fenway, which would be a lot bigger challenge. But, of course, you want to win
the division. They may even be the division leader in the East by then, the way that's going.
The Indians, they have an off day tomorrow. Do they have an off day tomorrow? They have an off day tomorrow. I don't see them on the Thursday schedule at all. So the Indians actually will have this game in Kansas City and then take a break before starting a series on Friday
in Baltimore.
That's another
reason why it could be Boston by the time the Tigers get to Fenway on Monday leading the East.
Yeah, it very well could. I mean, there's a showdown right there. That's a showdown that I'm really looking forward to. You know, the two division leaders, or two of the three division leaders in the American League, the Indians and Baltimore Orioles, who have that half-game edge over the Red Sox at the moment, and they're scheduled to start a series on Friday.
That Indians-Orioles series coming up over this weekend would be one of those great baseball examples of what happens at least from my point of view, I hope so. What happens when good pitching meets good hitting? No one will deny that the Orioles have a great lineup, but their pitching is awful. See the fact Ubaldo Jimenez is still in that rotation.
That's a great point. That is a very, very good point. When you think about that, that'll be kind of a mid to late season, you know, playoff type of preview. You know, about a team that mashes its way to the playoffs versus a team that just has the arms. And oh, by the way, while we're at it, just bringing it up, when you look at the team hitting leaders, the Indians actually still have a better lineup production wise than the Orioles do. And the Orioles have a very good lineup.
Which is insane to think of, because the Orioles are all about mashing the ball, basically.
Well, no question about it. But I mean, just in terms of runs scored, you know, if that's your metric, the best offenses in the American League. Let's see if I can pull this up here. Best offenses in the American League are, Boston with 505 runs scored, Toronto 468, Cleveland 461 third, then Texas 459, and the Orioles 452. They've scored nine fewer runs than the Indians have, despite having that tremendous lineup.
So, I got to say, that does surprise me a bit.
Me too.
By the way, final baseball update. It is now official in Detroit, 4-1 Twins win, so the Twins also take that series.
Now, batting average-wise, the Orioles have it better. They are the third team. Boston with 288 is a team batting average. Then KC, 271, and look where they are. Baltimore, 268, third. The Indians down to seventh in that category, 260 as a team. But from run production, as I pointed out, it's flipped a little bit there, third to fifth. So there you go. That's more baseball than I wanted to do, because I really do want to get into this NFL Rooney Rule story. So the Rooney Rule, as we know, was implemented to get more minority coaches into head coaching positions. And in order to get to those, you have to kind of get to the positions that lead to head coaching, including offensive and defensive coordinators. quarterbacks, coaches, et cetera. Now, all of the coaching changes that were made this particular year, all of the new head coaches came from offensive backgrounds. We know that this has become a passing league, and it's offensive ingenuity and offensive creativity and history, obviously, that you know, that GMs are looking for. That does indeed limit the opportunity for minority coaches, because there are fewer of them on the offensive side than there are defensive coordinators and, you know, linebackers, coaches, and the type. So I want to continue with this ESPN report so we can get a few more facts, and we'll get your thoughts on it,
Robert,
too.
Are these numbers that the NFL is aware of, are they aware, are you aware, that the number of minority first-time head coaches being hired has tailed off so drastically?
Well, Mike, about the numbers, you had pointed out the level of...
This is FYI. This is Robert Gulliver, the NFL's Executive Vice President of Human Resources, HR, so who, by the way, happens to be an African-American. I would say not that it matters, but it does matter because we're talking about the race of coaches.
...diversity prior to the Rooney Rule, and one thing that I would point out is that we've been looking at these numbers very carefully. In fact, we looked at a 12-year period before the implementation of the Rooney Rule, and in that period of time, there were six diverse head coaches. We then compared that to the 12-year period following the implementation of the Rooney Rule in 2013, and there have actually been 14 diverse head coaches. So that's nearly a 250% increase in the number of diverse head coaches since the implementation of the Rooney Rule.
By the way, just as an aside here, a comment from me, I've never heard the word diverse used in such a way. Diverse head coaches. What does that mean? We're not even allowed to say minority head coaches anymore, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about minorities. We're talking about African Americans, Latinos, or in other words, non-white guys getting these jobs. So they're calling them diverse head coaches. The PC police in this league and in this country, to me, are just so far off the hook. Now we can't even describe something as being majority or minority, which means in number. That's what it means. For those who didn't know, it's a numerical term. There are more of one thing than there are of another. That makes the one that is more the majority and the one that is fewer the minority. It's not a slur. It's not an insult. Yet they're calling them diverse head coaches, which is very strange.
I think that the Rooney Rule certainly is making a very big difference and having a very big impact relative to the
but
level
Robert,
of
to,
NFL.
But Robert, to Mike's point, many of those hires, or the vast majority of those hires, came off of the Tony Dungy coaching tree and have since then tailed off to the point where only one minority head coaching candidate has been hired over the last 4 years. Why?
Now, I'm going to pause again for my own commentary here, which is the point of all of this. I'm going to give you my view and ask you yours at 866-240-1065. And we'll hear the answer from Robert in a second. But the Tony Dungy coaching tree spawned a number of African-American head coaches. Great. Super. Things are working fine. If those particular head coaches aren't especially successful, then their coaching branches, if you will, are going to be limited, and therefore the Tony Dungy coaching tree dies and withers on the vine, if you will. And so that's the problem. It doesn't mean that the league has suddenly lost its commitment to diversity. It doesn't mean that the owners or the GMs have lost their commitment to hiring minority coaches or giving more minority coaches opportunities. But if they're going to pin this on the Tony Dungy coaching league, coaching tree, you're going to have to look at the coaching tree and see how successful it was. Maybe the Tony Dungy coaching tree didn't spawn any, you know, more branches. It didn't lead to any more growth because those coaches weren't as successful, perhaps, as everybody had hoped they would be. It doesn't mean that there is a problem as much as it means maybe the results weren't there. And like anybody, whether you're white or black or Latino or anything else, if you don't have the results, you know, you're not going to be given too many other opportunities, and the coaches you produce underneath you, the offensive coordinators, QB coaches, quality control coaches, et cetera, well, they're not going to get many opportunities to advance to head coaching situations of their own. We'll continue.
The coaching trees are certainly very important in football, but we are certainly doing a lot of work to make sure that coaches from a number of different trees get considered for head coaching positions. In fact, we're working very closely with Coach Dungy, but we're also working with others, including James Shaq Harris and Coach Danny Green, to make sure that we are providing inputs on the best possible candidates for head coaching positions. So coaching trees are absolutely important, and we're working with experts like Coach Dungy and others to make sure that we're canvassing the best possible coach candidates out there.
Jim, why are we seeing these numbers tail off so drastically?
I think ultimately it comes back to ownership, and it comes back to the league office in my mind from this standpoint. One, general managers don't hire head coaches. Owners hire head coaches. And on a daily basis, owners who are primarily white are not breaking bread with people of color. So,
all right, I'm going to pause that there because that is the crux of this, and this is where we get into the difficult part of the conversation that I mentioned before the top of the hour. It is difficult to talk about because emotions can sometimes get raw, especially and sadly, given the state of, given the state of race relations across the country as a whole today, this is an even more difficult subject to bring up right now, which I really wish ESPN hadn't done it, but here it is. Jim Trotter, by the way, this is an ESPN NFL reporter in this conversation on Outside the Lines. He is essentially saying that white owners hire the coaches and that white owners don't necessarily, as you heard him say, break bread with, in other words, hang around with or spend a lot of time with black coaches. Therefore, black coaches are being discriminated against because they don't have access to the owner's ear the way that a number of white coaches do. That is something that is controversial on its face because it is suggesting that white billionaire NFL owners just don't like to hang around black folks. And that is very, very difficult to hear. It is a very strong accusation to make. And I think it's a little bit irresponsible without some sort of evidence as to the truth of that. What may be true more so is that these particular owners have had success in their franchises with people with whom they are comfortable. And they may indeed be people of their same color. And you stay in your comfort zone, not necessarily stay away from a certain racial zone. And I think that inference that it may indeed be that way is let's just say, not contradictory. What's the word I'm looking for? It's not conducive to bringing about any solutions that may be required here. More from Jim Trotter.
When you look at that and you say, are these owners truly comfortable with these men? To me, this is all a red herring about offensive coordinators and defensive coordinators and whatnot. Because what happens is when you are hired from a coordinator position to be a head coach, one of the last things you do is actually be involved with coaching quarterbacks in this instance now, since we're talking about offense and the trend going towards offensive coordinators. When you look at the list of responsibilities for a head coach, X's and O's is down near the bottom. You have to be able to manage people. You have to be able to manage games. You have to be the face of the franchise and deal with the public. Your staff is what's important. So it's interesting to me that teams would come out and say, we need an offensive coordinator as our head coach, when he's not even going to be that involved with it, with a quarterback at that time.
But yet that's...
And again, I think that's another very, very strong generality that has been made in this case, in this issue, because it's not true. It's not true in every case, and it may not be true in many cases. I mean, Hugh Jackson was just hired by the Cleveland Browns. He's an African-American as the head coach. You heard he didn't even hire an offensive coordinator because he's going to call the plays. So to suggest that the head coach isn't that involved, tell me that again, Mike Tomlin, just to point to another African-American coach, tell me he's not very involved in the play calling with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Tell me he lets Todd Haley do it all himself. You must be crazy if you think he lets Todd Haley make all of those decisions on play calls, on going for it on fourth down, going for two-point conversions, etc. Tell me that Bill Belichick, who is a defensive guru, isn't very involved in the offensive plays, game plan for a particular team, game to game, season to season, situation to situation, series to series, down to down. Tell me he's not involved. Why do you think it is that so many offensive coordinators have gone through New England, had extraordinary success there, enough success to lead to their own head coaching gigs, and suddenly they show up in their own head coaching gigs, and they're not very good? Why is that? Why was Charlie Weiss the offensive guru for Bill Belichick during some of their Super Bowl years, the offensive guru so good that he got the Notre Dame job? Then when he got to Notre Dame, they found out he couldn't coach very well. Tell me Bill Belichick didn't have an impact on that. I think it is an absolutely irresponsible thing to say that the head coaches don't have an impact on the actual X's and O's and the game planning and scheming, that they're just got to deal with the public. You got to be a leader of men. You got to deal with the face of the franchise, but you're not necessarily doing all of this coaching. I disagree with that, and I've worked with some teams closely. I disagree with that just from top to bottom. On its face, I think that, and that's not to say it's not true in every situation. Maybe there are some where the coach is just the figurehead, and everybody else has responsibilities delegated to them by him, and he just sits back and watches it all happen. But my experience in talking with NFL coaches and being around NFL programs, franchises, that is just that's just patently false. They have a very important role, and it wouldn't be. I mean, let's look at it this way. If we are all in agreement, and most of the individuals on this panel discussion on Outside the Line seem to be, that the owners are making the decisions, and that there is a trend toward going toward my offensive coordinators and quarterbacks coaches to be the new head coaches of all these franchises. He said it's a red herring. Did all of them get together and conspire to say, in order to make sure that we have more white coaches and we don't have to bring in too many other black coaches, let's just say we're going to offense. Let's just say we're looking at offense. That'll be our new trend now, because offenses have taken such a predominant role in the league. It's a passing league. Every year somebody else new is throwing for 5,000 yards and 45 touchdowns, and so we need guys who can do that, who can get the most out of our quarterbacks. That'll be what we do. Do we think that they conspired to create that red herring? Or is it more likely that seven different NFL owners who hired new coaches during an offseason individually thought to themselves, I know what I'll do. I'll just hire me an offensive coach. That way I can get away with hiring a white guy, and I can say, look, there just aren't very many minority coordinators and quarterbacks coaches out there that I could have chosen from, and I wanted an offensive guy. And I'll just say that this is the real reason. It'll be a red herring. Did they come up with that on their own, seven different individuals? Or let's go behind door number three. Is it possible that owners get together with their general managers and they say, we need to make a change. What do we need to do? And they all come together and say, look at what is winning championships. Look at what is winning games. It is a passer's league. We are going to have to figure out how to put a lot of points on the board in order to, unless we have an all-time elite defense, by the way, like the Broncos had this past season, and they carried Peyton Manning's injured 39-year-old body to a championship under tremendous pressure provided by Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware and great coverage from corners like Harris and Tlaib, etc. Unless you have one of those, you are going to have to build a tremendously dynamic passing offense. And in order to do that, we need great offensive minds, quarterbacks, coaches who can get through and do these sorts of things. And it doesn't matter what color they are, we're just looking for offense, which is most likely the case. Did they conspire to keep minority coaches or diverse coaches, as they're being called, at least in the ESPN report, out of those positions, or are they just hiring guys that have been in those positions that they know are successful? Let's continue.
Exactly how the NFL is hiring, right, Jim? We saw the statistics that 80% are coming from offensive or defensive coordinator ranks. So is that not how this problem must be fixed, through the pipeline that Hugh Jackson talked about?
No, it's not. And in my opinion, if you go back to when, for instance, Herm Edwards was hired to coach the Jets, the league office was involved with that behind the scenes in terms of stressing the importance of a minority hire. And it's not that Herm wasn't qualified, it's that the league recognized that there was a problem. I don't see the league making that same push today to say that it's important that we have diversity at the head coaching ranks, particularly among first-time head coaches.
Let me ask you this, Andrew. We have this conversation.
And that's a question I want to ask you. As you listen and to all of this commentary and all of this analysis, is it important to have diversity among head coaches in the National Football League? I mean, there's 32 jobs, and there's 64 coordinator jobs. Is it important to have diversity there? That's the question. Is it any more important to have diversity there than it is to have diversity among the players? Because that has often been a question that is asked by a lot of people. Wait a second. Nobody cares about the lack of diversity among players in the NBA, in the NFL, in Major League Baseball, and so on and so forth. Basically, the best guys get the jobs. And if the best guys happen to be predominantly African-American, then so be it. Nobody's going to say we need more white guys to diversify the league. But when it comes to the coaching ranks, they're saying we do need to have more people of color to diversify the league. Why is it in one case but not the other? That is a question that I'm asking you. Do you think it matters? At 866-240-1065. Here's more.
Often independent of What is appropriate? What is the right number of minority head coaching candidates? Should it reflect society? African Americans make up 11% of the U.S. population. Or should it reflect the players in the NFL who make up two-thirds of the NFL population?
And then, the follow-up question there is the one that I was just asking. If coaching ranks should make up reflect society and the population breakdown, the demographics, why shouldn't the playing ranks? Would make sense, would it? We're not going to go ahead and use affirmative action to give people who aren't good enough to play in the NFL jobs there just to diversify it. But yet we're going to do something of that nature for the coaching ranks. Does that seem sensible to anybody?
What is the unwritten undercurrent here is what's the right number we should be searching for, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, there's no right number. I guess it's somewhere in between those extremes you talked about. Listen, I was with the Packers. We were in the league at 2003 when the Rooney Rule was activated. It was a great measure. It was a great gesture. The question I had at that time and still have is, you mean it's just the head coach? So we're just dealing with the top of the pyramid, the one position. Now, it has been extended to front office positions, executive positions as well, in sort of a Rooney Rule 2.0, but we really need a 3.0. We really need to extend this to positionals, where this is where the network starts. This is where the infrastructure happens of all these positions. When we get down to the position, even the quality control positions, then you build up the grassroots level, as you said, towards the top of the pyramid, and we're not talking about top down. I think that's what needs to happen, and you made a point, check the box. That's a real problem here because owners, what do? They go to people they know, they hear from people they know, and this increasing use of search firms are now getting involved where they're really checking the box, having plausible deniability if it doesn't work out, and these coaching search firms don't have enough minority candidates in their book of business.
These owners.
That's
rely.
Andrew Brandt, by the way. Andrew Brandt is ESPN business analyst. He is also a former vice president with the Packers. Just another 40 seconds here of commentary, and then I want to take a break, and then I'm going to get your phone calls on this. So this is an ESPN Outside the Lines report on the Rooney Rule and the lagging in minority hiring among coaches. After a lot of great growth when the Rooney Rule was first implemented back in 2003.
Unfortunately, on a limited number of people when making these hires, many of these hires for head coaches and general managers. For instance, if you're talking about hiring a general manager, who do many of these teams go to? They go to Ernie Accorsi or they go to Ron Wolf. And that's not in any way to put down these men who are quality men. But I'm just saying you have to broaden your search than beyond these two and just who they know. So to me, it's almost insulting in some ways where we point out, and I have great respect for Tony Dungy, you point out his tree, which is tremendous, but is he the only voice that NFL owners are listening to when it comes to hiring African-American head coaches? I have a problem with it. 43%? Come on.
That's Jim Trotter, again, an ESPN reporter and commentator. All right, so you've heard all of the different angles of this whole thing. Now I want your thoughts on it. A, does the Rooney Rule need to be expanded to include more interviews for more positions, including position coaches? B, does any of this even matter? Do you think any coach in the any owner in the National Football League is evaluating somebody's qualifications or capabilities to lead their teams to championships based on their skin color? Do you think anybody is being discriminated against because of their skin color for any of these coveted positions? And if so, what do you propose we do to fix the problem? Want your thoughts on it at 866-240-1065. Right after this, get a timeout now in Sports Center from Jim Cushlin on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. It is the extravaganza for another 16 minutes. Then it's drive time with Mr. Mike Miller on vacation. Mr. Jim Cushlin will be in. Cushlin's got a full plate today, huh?
Yes, enjoying it. I'm in for Mike the next 2 weeks, taking one of those last summer vacations, I suppose.
What's on the show?
Well, I'm going to talk about some of these games we saw today. And I mean, there's so many little side bits, as we kind of were already talking about earlier, Bob. But there's so many little side bits to to all of these and look into the trade rumor pile again, because it is that time of the year after all. And then, of course, our weekly outdoors segment with Matt Markey of the Blade, as is the case every Wednesday on Drive Time.
All right, very good. Where's Miller? Is he out somewhere with Mike Golick taking a note, just taking another Mike day off?
Maybe. I haven't been able to get a hold of him, so he's got to be by the pool.
They got to change the name of the ESPN morning show from Mike and Mike to Mike and some other guy, or some other guy and Mike, because one or other is missing constantly.
Yeah, it has felt like it, certainly the last month or so that's been the case, but that's the way it goes, honestly. I mean, anybody out there, think of your national shows. You're probably hearing a lot of the different guest hosts these days, because the normal guys are taking their vacation before football. And
I'm still sitting here. I'm not taking vacations. In fact, I don't know if I've taken a week-long vacation in the almost 2 years I've been doing this show. I'll take a day here and there. But none of these 1 and 2 week jaunts away from the job that you guys do. You guys who aren't committed and dedicated to the listener, you know.
Good call on that.
That's
one. And just for the record, then, no, I will not be taking any weeks off or anything, though I may be taking my daughter's birthday off.
I think you have the permission to do that. Hey, by the way, Carlos Carrasco slipping a little bit. He walked somebody last inning. So
yeah, there was actually two base runners on last inning.
Yeah. What did he do? Hit somebody, too? He still has only the one hit allowed.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a couple of walks. Let me double check. Yes, indeed. Pair of walks.
Oh, is it a pair of walks? Okay.
Pair of walks.
I thought he had one walk. Oh, no, he did. He did not have a walk. Okay, until that inning. All right. So
and
anyway.
Dan Otero's now in, so it goes in the books as 6 innings of one hit shutout baseball.
One hit. No runs, 6 strikeouts, 2 walks, ERA down to 2.31. Once he gets his inning count up to the minimum required to be listed among the league leaders, he will be the leading ERA pitcher in the American League. By a lot, by the way.
Yeah.
By a lot. Because Danny Salazar, his teammate, is currently leading with a 2.75, and he's at 2.31. If he keeps this kind of thing up for about 2 or 3 more starts, he'll start to be listed up there and get the credit that he deserves. So the Indians pounding the Royals. What's that?
Oh, absolutely.
Indians pounding the Royals 11-0. Bottom of the 7th in Kansas City, so they will push their lead, which is amazing to me that the defending champions that we said we can never sleep on, never sleep on the Royals, after this game, they're going to be 9 back. They're going to be 9 back of the Indians headed toward August, and I know we're still on July 20th, but getting closer to August than we are to the start of July, the Indians will have a 7.5 game lead after this one is finished because the Tigers lost today. 2 out of 3 they lost in Minnesota, against Minnesota. How does that happen, too? And that's got to be the most frustrating.
Well,
part.
Explained kind of how it happens on a day like this. Verlander is outstanding after Kinsler leads off in the first with a home run. The bats go completely silent, and then there it is again, bringing non-closers into non-save situations.
That's the easy answer. That's the easy answer is Rodriguez, the closer, comes in a non-save and blows it. But what about the fact that the bats went silent, as you said? This is just the kind of thing.
This is a Twins rotation, by the way, which is one of the two worst rotations in the American League. You know who's second worst? And this is why I'm starting to sleep on them, is Kansas City. Kansas City, Minnesota have the two worst starting rotations statistically in the American League right now.
Although Irvin Santana's not a scrub.
He's one of the few veterans they do have on that staff.
Yeah, and his ERA is 3.93. So, again, in the American League, anything under 4, you're doing pretty well. So he is, he's...
Credit where credit's due. He went 7 strong himself, run on 6 hits.
But I mean, just to the point, though, at hand here, if you're the Tigers, you cannot play. If you're trying to catch the Indians to win this division, you can't play, a 3-game set at home against the Minnesota Twins, the worst team in your division, and one of the 2 or 3 worst teams in all of baseball record-wise, and lose 2 out of 3 in your own building. You just don't do that, especially when you built a little bit of momentum by winning 2 out of 3 against the Royals.
Yeah,
you take
absolutely.
2 out of 3 against a division rival in a situation where you've got to win in your division. You're starting the second half off with three straight series in your division. The defending champion is the one you take a 2 out of 3 from, and then you lose to the worst team in the league. 2 out of 3 like this, that just can't happen.
And especially right now, because as you mentioned, it's now back to it's 7 right now because it's not official yet, but it'll soon be 7.5. And if you're the Tigers, TikTok, time's a-wasting if you're going to make some kind of a move to try to stay in this thing. And I still get this feeling that the Tigers, honestly, Bob, are still internally debating if they really want to buy or sell. They're probably getting a nudge to possibly buy from Mike Ilitch, but you got to wonder if that's even the smart move. I know the same debate's going on with them damn Yankees right now, and there's some that are actually for the first time seemingly ever rooting for them to lose. And then for these KC Royals, you talk about not sleeping on them. I may now, because I don't know which one you want to, which number that I'm about to throw out there that you want to use to more encapsulate where the Royals stand right now. Do you use the fact that they're 9 games out when this eventually goes final, or the fact that this loss will drop them to the 500 mark?
That is
both are equally troubling if you're a Kansas City Royals fan.
Those are both pretty amazing to think about. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. But just looking at it from the Tiger standpoint, I think you're right. They are internally debating whether or not they want to make a move and whether or not they are still contenders for real, and that somebody can come in and you know getting a free agent who is heading into it, or excuse me, getting a star caliber player who is heading into his free agent year. That you want to make an acquisition for to make a run for the division, or do you have to be realistic and say, I mean, Jim, I'm not trying to tick anybody off here, but you've played the Indians 12 times and you're 1-11 against them. You're not built to beat them to close this now 7.5 game gap unless you really added a couple of pieces. One of them should probably be a starter. One of them should probably be a bat, because I don't know where JD Martinez stands. You're going to need a lot to try to close.
Don't forget
that
an
gap
extra bullpen arm, which every team that's contending always wants.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be enough.
No,
I mean, just truthfully, I mean, I don't think they're built that way. I just don't. I mean, especially given the rotation, the injuries to Zimmerman and Norris, and obviously just how Sanchez fell flat.
And we haven't even mentioned Pelfrey and all this. He was supposed to be a halfway decent veteran innings eater,
and he's been
nothing. He's been horrible,
I mean,
honestly.
As great as Fulmer has been in his could-be, would-be, maybe rookie of the year season, Pelfrey has been just that bad. Verlander has been solid, not spectacular, but solid with an ERA of
3.75. And then he gets outings like today completely wasted.
Exactly right. I just thought, if I'm in the Tigers front office and I'm part of that internal debate you're talking about, I am making it very clear which side I'm on. And that is, we cannot win this thing. If we go and mortgage what is already an extraordinarily bleak-looking future in terms of prospects, by trading away even more of what we don't have in order to try to get somebody to make a run at the Indians in this division right now, based on the way they look and the way we look, we are killing ourselves for the next several years to come. I am thinking, no way do we do this. In fact, if we've got any movable parts here that somebody else might need, we do that to replenish our farm.
I was just going to ask that, and a little tease here. I'm going to actually try to start getting into some of that coming up next when I'm in for Mike on Drive Time, because it's a question Tigers fans, either because they truly don't, I can't hear you, or they truly haven't thought about it. Who would you trade away if you're going to be in sell mode?
Tigers. Do they have any pieces that are coming up on free agency years?
What I got to double check, because honestly, I haven't looked at that list even myself in here in a little bit.
I have to admit, I haven't either. And
because
the
I just
why,
assumed they'd be in it enough that they'd be buy or stand pat. I never entertained the thought that they'd be selling.
I don't think they are fully either,
but it might be something they should look into.
Usually you think they're either going to be buyers or they're going to stand pat with what they have
right,
and try to win it, not the other way around, that we're going to actually sell. Now, one thing I think we can probably say is, be pretty confident in saying, is that Mr. Ilitch isn't going to allow that to happen.
That's part of the reason I personally had been assuming they wouldn't be in sell low, because right now Mike Ilitch kind of won't allow it.
Yeah,
if you will.
I mean, we know where he is. He is in buy, get me a championship now while I can still enjoy it, and I'm here to enjoy it, et cetera. And I don't mean to be morose. I'm just being, or anything else or insulting. But, he wants to win while he can. And That's why, you know, there was a debate even in the offseason about what kind of moves they should make.
And actually looking at
Justin Upton, should they spend and say we can get there quickly, or should they say, okay, this is not going to be able to be fixed in a couple of offseason moves. We're just not good enough. We've got to build for the future.
Yeah,
and we know where he stands on that.
Yeah, and I'm looking up and down at some of their guys right now. Mike Avilas is a free. These are guys who will be free agents after this season ends. Mike Avilas will be a free agent. Let's see.
That's not going to bring you any problems.
Right. No, Iglesias still has arbitration. Jared Salt Lamakia will be a free agent. I don't think none of the rest are even arbitration eligible. Technically, J.D. Martin, check that. It's Francisco Rodriguez. He has a club option for next year, as does Cameron Maybin. So if you're in sell mode, that's going to be about it. Everybody else is signed or is young enough to still be arbitration eligible.
So there's just not too many pieces.
Right.
That are movable. So you're not going to be able to get your farm system replenished by moving somebody, by saying we are sellers rather than buyers.
Here's a twisted thought, though, since one of them is Jared Salamakia. If they're in sell mode and you're Alavila, do you call the Indians and say, what would you give me for Salty?
Well, and
because that, you know, I know the Indians, I mentioned earlier, the Indians are sounding like they're reluctant to make that kind of move. But if you're the Indians, you're still in a world where for a minimum one to the next 2 months, you're going with Chris Jimenez and Roberto Perez behind the plate. Regardless of what Gomes has done at the dish, he's still incredibly valuable out there with the gear on.
Yeah, and you know, but how much more are you getting with Salty Lamakia if you are?
You're getting a veteran, capable catcher who also has a capable bat. He's had a halfway decent season for the Tigers.
He's got a capable bat in that he's got 9 home runs, but he's also hitting 200. You know, I mean, he's a Mendoza hitter.
That's
how
because
much...
he's been splitting time all year. He and McCann have been more or less because McCann's their catcher of the future.
He's the main guy. Right.
Salty is not part of their long-term plans.
My point being, though, given what he is and what he brings, I can't imagine he would bring much from the Indians. They wouldn't be able to command very much for a 200 hitting catcher.
Right.
You know, does it bring a double A guy over or a double A guy and a single A guy? I don't know. Maybe, possibly. From the Indians, would the Indians be willing to part with anything of value or substance for Salty Lamakia due to Gomes' injury? Probably not. Again.
Then, of course, you have trading within your own division, and teams usually don't like to do that.
That is very true. They don't. And again, if you're the Indians, how much do you really want to change anyway, given the fact that even with Gomes out and you know, this is not...
That's why, until further notice, I buy those reports that catcher-wise, they're reluctant. It's reliever, and maybe now with the Brantley news, maybe an outfielder. But otherwise, I'm almost thinking the Indians are just going to try to go get a reliever or two. I still kind of think that's the case.
The only thing I consider with all of that is Gomes' value to the pitching staff, which is, of course, the best in the American League. You know, he calls games for all of them except Carrasco, and if his
you can't overlook that
affects how they pitch, then that is something that they may have to address. All right, music is playing. I hear it. That means we're done. Thanks for a great conversation today. Tomorrow, we are back again at 3 o'clock with the Thursday edition of the Extravaganza. Anthony Fenech will join us then to talk a little Tigers baseball. We'll kind of kick this around now that we'll be even closer to the trading deadline.
10 days at that point.
That's right. That's exactly right. And as for now, stay where you are because drive time is coming your way. Cushlin in for Miller right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.